Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit corin.com.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, a food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from Brooklyn, New York. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deal in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi, ramen, izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. My guest today is Michael Tremblay, who is a sake samurai, international sake judge, sake sommelier, and a certified sake educator based in Toronto, Canada. And Michael is also the co-author of the new book, Exploring the World of Japanese Craft Sake, Rice, Water, Earth, from Taro Publishing. And this book is not an ordinary book on sake. It not only covers the basics of sake with unique insights, but also discusses more advanced topics such as new rice varieties, and water mineral contents, and how these elements articulate the terroir in each region. But make no mistake, this book is a fun read rather than textbook, although you would learn so much from it without trying. So you also get to meet people from 35 breweries and other key players in the sake industry, such as koji providers and female toji. So today we'll discuss how Michael became a renowned sake expert and educator, intriguing topics featured in his new book, including latest trends of popular sake rice, how newly developed flower yeasts are challenging the flavors of sake, Japan's diverse regional terroir, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Please go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, whichever you listen to, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write to review. We really appreciate your feedback. Now, let's start a conversation with Michael Tremblay. Hello, Michael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Akiko-san. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, so this is exciting. Your book is just fantastic. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we're very proud of it. And we're so excited at seeing everyone around the world finally getting their copies and showing their joy of it. So it's really heartwarming.
Right. It could be a wonderful summary with a glass of sake, chilled sake in your hand, and you can have a good time with it. So
definitely, yes.
Right. So first of all, to get to know you, where are you from and what did you eat when you grew up?
It's a very good question. So I have an interesting background. I was born in Montreal, Canada, which is in the province of Quebec, which is largely French speaking. So I grew up as French Canadian, and I didn't actually learn English until I was about six or seven. My father was in the military, and we traveled quite a bit. And so some of my early experiences were having local Quebecois food. We lived in a really small radar defense town called Chibougamau. It's kind of a funny name, but it was right in the middle of nowhere in northern Quebec. And hunting was a really popular pastime for a lot of the people in the area. So it wasn't uncommon for me to have caribou or game. Also, a local delicacy in Quebec is called tortière. And my family made it quite often. So I really grew up loving that, even when we moved to other parts of Canada.
Wow. So Well, I went to Montreal and I really found the food culture is very unique and also the mindset of France and Canada. So yeah, you're definitely a global person and it makes sense that you are in completely different culture called Japan. So that's interesting. And your whole life seems to be about sake, although I heard that you are also a triathlete, composer, and painter. So how did you get into sake?
Yeah, it's a funny story. I finished my master's in Toronto at York University, and I joined a friend who was living in Halifax on the east coast of Canada in recording an album. And while I was there, I was bartending, you know, to make ends meet. And one of my early bosses, one of our managers, was really passionate about wine. He always carried around a wine book. And so I kind of indirectly fell in love with wine through him. So I signed up for some wine courses when I got back in to Ontario. And eventually, you know, I really loved learning about the history of the world through the lens of wine, you know, just all these fascinating little pockets of history everywhere. And so when I'd have a glass of wine, I always would think about what was going on here and what influenced the wine that I was drinking. And about 16 years ago, I got a job at Key Modern Japanese and Bar in Toronto. And back then, Key was a really big restaurant, a very busy restaurant. It had quite a large sake program at the time. And we had about 20 to 25 sake or so. And that was my first exposure with sake is starting here. And I really fell in love with sake through telling the stories of the brewers. Back then, I was still learning about sake, and sake in general was a bit of a mystery in Toronto and in other parts of Canada. There wasn't a lot of sake educators or courses available in Canada. And so because I was at a company that was quite successful, they had the financial means to send me to courses where I could learn about sake, I was able to kind of demystify things and bring some of that knowledge to Toronto. Much like, I guess, the toji back in the Edo period, you know, these rice farmers that would go and learn sake brewing techniques and bring them back to their villages. I guess there's kind of a cool symmetry there.
Right. And it's interesting. Every single person I met and the sake expert, they fall in love with producers, which you feature a lot in your book too. So yeah, sake is just not the beverage. It's so much beyond just the tastiness. So, and before I forget, so you became a sake samurai in 2018. And could you explain what the title is?
Yes. So it's a unique title where every year about five individuals from around the world that are doing are doing good things in the world of sake or promoting Japanese culture are invited to Kyoto. There's a shrine there called Matsuno Taisha, and my understanding is it's a 1300 year old shrine to sake. And you're invited to undergo a Shinto purification ceremony and then a sake samurai ceremony where you're inducted in. And then you have this really nice extravagant dinner to celebrate. And when you're inducted as the sake samurai, the whole idea is that you've done good things and you're being recognized for it, but you're also kind of vowing to continue trumpets Japanese culture and Japanese sake, which is very easy for me. I'm very passionate, not just about Japanese sake, but about how it ties in with Japanese culture and its history. It's a huge honor to have been bestowed this honor, because you can't apply for it. You know, it's not like doing a WSET diploma or a Master of Wine where you can decide to do it and do all the studying and work towards it. The Sake Samurai is something that is kind of out of your hands. The sake brewers themselves are nominating people from around the world, and then there's some kind of a vote as to who's determined to be to become a sake samurai. So it's a huge honor for me to have been chosen from a panel of sake brewers themselves, and it's I think the greatest honor I could ask for.
Right, they did a great job to select you, and I remember that Tim Sullivan, one of the other sake samurais, when he was at the shrine, he swore to himself he was going to be the biggest teacher, and you will never forget what he said. So you're definitely, in the right group of people to educate all of us.
Definitely. Well, thank you very much. And I mean, Timothy Sullivan and, John Garner and Bo Timken, these are, and even Toshio Ueno in LA, these are legends in the sake world for me. And when I learned about sake, when I started learning about sake, these are people that the names that I came across. So I looked up to them, and so to become one of them, so to speak, as a sake samurai was a huge honor for me. I feel like it's big shoes to fill, and I'm hoping to, I think I'll always. It won't be good enough for me. I'll always try to do more and more and more in the sake world. Someone else I forgot is Chizuko Nizawa Helton from New York as well. She was one of the early people that I met in Toronto, actually, when she was doing Kanpai Festival of Sake here. We became friends.
Chizuko is amazing too. She's really pushing. She's a big cheerleader of the sake culture globally, people and listeners who haven't come across great sake culture stuff yet, and can you describe first eye-opening moment with your Japanese sake?
Yes, it's a really interesting question because, at first, nothing came to mind. I know some people have instantly, this is the sake that blew my mind. And I think for me, where I realized I absolutely love sake, I was working at Key, and it had been a few years, and I had maps of Japan that I would put on the doors of the fridges, so that, back then in the early days at Key, sake was from Japan. It wasn't from Niigata or Yamagata or a specific area. It was just from Japan. It was very generic. And I kept seeing certain names. I was like, well, why are they making sake here? I don't understand. I want to understand this. And so I remember I had finished presenting a sake to a table, and I'd finished telling them a story. I really loved presenting a bottle of sake to a guest and making them feel like they're traveling to that area. And so I fell in love with sake, I think, because I love telling the stories of all these really old breweries. Now, with that said, I think the first sake that I had that really was something I really enjoyed, and I'd already been enjoying sake, but I really liked the sake of Dewa Zakura Shuzo, and particularly sakes with Dewa Sansan rice. I remember I had a Dewa Zakura Jumai Ginjo made with Dewa Sansan, and then I really liked it, and I don't know why, but then maybe a few months later, I had another Dewa Sansan sake, another Jumai Ginjo, I think from a different producer. And I was like, I really liked Dewa Sansan rice. It has a certain flavor to me. It was savory yet fruity, very pretty. It had this almost a really interesting mouthfeel. And so then I went back to Dewa Zakura Shuzo, and I tried more of their sake, and I really fell in love with the sake. And this was even before understanding the history and their significance to the whole Ginjo sake making, which I know we talk about in Nancy and I's book.
Right. So yes, it's in the book, and I enjoy that the text too. So, and then you know, of course, you're a French wine scholar. You said it's, you know, you started from wines, but how do you describe what's special about sake to you personally?
Yeah, well, what I love about it is how old it is as a beverage. And I know wine is ancient as well, I think Japanese sake captures my imagination. I think because when you also visit Japan, you really still see the history at the brewery level. If you visit a lot of wineries, and I'm not knocking wine at all, but a lot of wineries have modernized. There's modern equipment and modern facilities. You don't have this 400-year-old wooden building still where the original winery is. I'm sure those exist, but for the most part, when you visit a sake brewery in Japan, even the ones that are modern have this element of history. You can see how old the brewery is, several hundreds of years old, and that captures the imagination, and it's one thing that I love about it. Another is that sake is quite a difficult beverage to make. You got a number of microorganisms that have to as the toji, bring into balance in order to create a really good sake. And while sake brewers really make it look easy, it's very difficult. And I have some friends that have said, Michael, why don't you make sake? You're a sake expert. I said, no, I will never make sake because it's too difficult. And, you know, to work with koji and kojikin and yeast and make them happy with one another and into creating a great sake. I'd rather enjoy sake and not be disappointed at my failures in making a sake that I wouldn't drink. So, yeah.
Right. I completely agree. You teach and you understand you teach. okay. And then I heard you visited over 50 sake breweries in Japan. So what did you see and learn from these extensive visits?
Yeah, well, I think for the book research, Nancy and I visited between 35 and 40 sake breweries. And I've probably visited about 80 or 90 to this point, which is really, I feel very lucky and fortunate because I've traveled to prefectures in Japan that I think many Japanese probably haven't gone to. I've been to maybe about 35 prefectures now. One thing that I find I have learned was that just as you feel you know everything or like you have a firm grasp on a certain concept of sake, you'll visit a brewer that turns it on its head, which means that it's really hard to put your finger on every aspect of it. And I think that's one of the things I love about it as well, is that it's always intriguing. You can never stop learning about it because there's the historical side, but you'll visit a brewery that's doing something that you've never seen. And then you go to another brewery and they're doing something that you've never seen. And it's really interesting. Now, with that said, on our trips to Japan for research, we talked to brewers that were Omi Shonin, so that and we were able to connect that history in our book. We talked to a brewer in Hiroshima, Imada-san from Imada Shuzo, who was starting to work with this whole idea of polishing the rice in a henpei, like a flat way, along the contours of the shinpaku or a genkei, which is a more circular. And that really was exciting for me. I know Daishichi as well was a brewery that has done it. But for some reason, I've read about the flat rice polishing from Daishichi, and it never really kind of connected until I was at Imada Shuzo and trying two bottles of sake where the rice was polished in different ways, but everything else about the brewery, about the sakes were the same. It was really eye-opening because it made me think, well, where are we heading? You know, these are new advancements now, and It means that there's so much more on the in the near future of sake that is going to continue to evolve that we don't know yet. And that captures my imagination as well. I start wondering, oh, well, what's next? What are they going to do? If Imada-san is doing this and other brewers start doing this, does it mean that we'll need the Tokutei Shoshu system anymore because of the grading of sake, because it means that you can remove less of the rice and create a sake that is that tastes like it, more of the rice was polished away. So it kind of starts to make you think, well, what happens to the polish rates? Anyway, I'm getting a little too technical, but these are some of the kind of philosophical adventures that Nancy and I were exposed to that were really fascinating.
Right. So basically, I was thinking of this classic Japanese phrase called onkochishi, means all things are precious, but you have to keep updating it and then review what's important, what needs to be changed. And that's exactly the example you said. You know, basically, for listeners who are not familiar, is also polishing rice. To make sake, you have to polish rice. And then the level of polishing changes, the grade, so-called grade of sake, ginjo, daiginjo, all those things. But what Michael is just talking about is that the most efficient way to polish rice, which is only possible now because there's no technology to which part of rice you can, just like a small grain of rice, how can you polish it? So technically refined way. So that's definitely a good reason that why Japanese sake breweries are still very precious, even becoming more powerful in the global stage, because they never stop improving themselves. And unfortunately, all of the breweries are not that lucky to be able to find a way to financially succeed. But that's interesting. And someone like you really pushing their back moving forward. So, yeah.
And I love what you said about how breweries, seem to have one foot rooted in the tradition and the history that of where they come from, and also having almost one foot moving forward and into new sake adventures. And, and you see it a lot. There's some sake breweries that have, several brands. One brand is a very traditional sake that may or may not leave the prefecture. It's more for the local people and of that region. And it's more of a traditional sake that, they've been making for generations. Whereas then they have a new brand that's really modern and, appeals to consumers in export markets and Tokyoites alike. So I think there's no shortage of ideas coming out of Japan and sake brewers themselves into what to do next.
Right. So in other words, we are really facing a very interesting time for the next generation sake industry. Right. Okay. So we'll take a quick break here. And when we come back, we'll dive into Michael's exciting new book, Exploring the World of Japanese Craft Sake, Rice, Water, Earth. So please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Corin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Corin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant, from French to Pan-Asian to American, and that is why they are located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Corin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Corin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit corin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Needs on HLN Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Akiko Teyama, and my guest today is Michael Tremblay, who is a sake samurai, international sake judge, sake sommelier, and certified sake educator based in Toronto, Canada. So let's talk about your new book. Again, it's the title, Exploring the World of Japanese Craft Sake, Rice, Water, Earth, from Taro Publishing. And I really think this really, the title represents everything important in the sake industry. So, and you wrote this book, which is Nasi Matsumoto, who is an excellent writer based in New York and Toronto, and super knowledgeable about Japanese sake, food and culture. So yeah, well, for the time restriction, I couldn't invite both of you here, but I'm hoping to have some time to have Nancy for some other topics. She's really so broadly educated about Japanese culture. So, but anyways, how did you guys decide to write the book together?
Well, so Nancy and I met in Toronto for the first time. She had recently moved to Canada with her husband. They lived in New York, but her husband was originally from around Toronto. So they decided to move here, and they still have a place in New York as well. And it just happened that around the time that she moved here, or shortly after, John Gondner held his first sake professional course in Toronto. So John Gondner is a renowned sake educator, of course, and his course here was a great thing, and he was one of my early senseis, and as well as a lot of other people in Toronto and you know in other parts of Canada. And so at the end of his course, John and I decided to have this patio party with our with alumni and his students at Kimono Japanese and Bar, and so we brought all the rest of the sakes that were left over from the course. If you've ever taken a course with John, there's always a lot of sake left over because there's a lot of sake that you try throughout the course, and so it's a great way of reacquainting yourself with all these fantastic sakes and sake brands. And so Nancy and I met here at Key, and we became good sake friends. We kept in touch. Nancy, every once in a while, was writing an article that had a sake angle, and she would reach out, and we would talk and whatnot. And so we eventually decided to go out for sake and some food at a restaurant called Omai. It's a small restaurant, but with a great sake list. And we started talking about almost casually at the time about having a sake, writing a sake book. At the time, I was at the tail end of developing my sake scholar course, which is a course on sake regionality. And, we started thinking, well, we could do something together. And a few months later, we had more drinks and we kept talking about it. But then Nancy went to a fellowship in the U.S. called Stone Barns, which is a fairly prestigious fellowship, and it brings together all these successful women that are talking about projects that they want to eventually, there's ideas that they want to develop in the future. And so on the last day of this fellowship, as Nancy had mentioned to me, basically everyone presents on something that they want to talk about or to develop a project that they want to get off the ground, and hopefully someone in the circle of people will kind of speak up and go, hey, I can help you with that. And so she mentioned our book idea, which again at the time was quite relaxed. It was more a casual conversation. But she got a lot of great feedback. There were two book agents there that were really interested in representing us. And so I remember getting an email from Nancy saying, hey, Michael, I think we're onto something. There's two people here that really think our idea is great. So that kind of actually started to light the fire. We got together and we started discussing who would be a good agent for us. And we ended up with a great gentleman based in Washington named Max, who gave us a lot of sage advice throughout the whole book creation process. And then we put together a proposal and got the book going, and the rest is history. I feel like I should stop there for a second and let you speak, Akiko-san.
So, no, but it's amazing that, you know, how the ideas becomes actual thing, right? And it's very exciting. I like the process. You really have to keep thinking. And yeah, somebody told me that it's better to not to think too much and just like say it, say something to someone. And eventually you realize how serious you are about the idea. So in your case, it's just that's a good proof of what I heard. So what is the theme of the book?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So the book is essentially in three parts. We've got our first section is a sake basic section. And because Nancy and I were going to tackle a lot of subjects, some of them quite advanced, some of them, you know, more relaxed. And there was all kinds of other elements in it. We really wanted to set up the book so that if you were new to sake, you could still get a lot out of the book. And if you're, a sake enthusiast that's been around sake for 10 years, there's something there that you're going to enjoy as well. And so what was important for us was having a sake basic section. And the sake basic section contains a lot of infographics. We wanted to be very colorful about it. I remember some of my first experiences learning about sake, and when it's too many words, and as a non-Japanese person, trying to learn even just three or four Japanese words in one go it could be a lot and it can be overwhelming. So we wanted to make sure that we had a way of explaining what sake is, where you could read through it with a glass of sake and not be very confused and really enjoy the experience. And then the rest of the book is divided into two parts. We've got our first part, which covers rice, water, and earth. So we really explore rice. We also explore how the rice has been treated, i.e., polished down to high degrees, and the ginjo boom. So we try to connect the history and where sake is heading. And then we also talk about mountains and the idea of water and even subjects like terroir that can be a bit divisive in not just in the wine world but also in the sake world. Well, it is something that we heard numerous times from sake producers, so we wanted to make sure we kind of explored these themes. In the second part, we really delve into the world of the alchemists, so the koji merchants, so the proprietors of some brewers. And it's funny, it never occurred to me as a sake educator and all that to think, a few years ago, where does koji kin come from? I don't know if I just thought it was magic or you went on to Amazon and bought it, which is ridiculous. But it's this, there's these fantastic companies with quite a rich history that create these spores, this magical mold that we called koji kin, that brewers purchase. And then we also wanted to talk to scientists that are developing new sake yeast. And then as well in this whole second half of the book, we wanted to talk, we were very lucky to ask a lot of the sake brewers that we had visited whether they'd be okay sharing some of their home cooking recipes that go well with the sake that they make. And so we've got a chapter on recipes of traditional Japanese foods that you could make to go with sake. And even in some cases, some of the recipes include sake kasu or sake itself. So that was really, really fun for us. And then in that chapter as well, or in that second half of the book, we also talked to we also recommend a few sake bars, if you're visiting Japan, where to maybe to look out for. Although, with that said, Nancy and I are both in agreement that there's so many other amazing sake bars out there to experience that our list is kind of like a step one, but really you should kind of delve out there and see what's out there. And we also talk to sake brewers from that are non-Japanese. So the movement of sake brewers that is growing around the world outside of Japan, and that was a really interesting chapter as well.
Right, and in other words, we really captured what's happening in this moment of sake industry, which is interesting because we tend to focus more on the traditions and what to preserve, but we kind of always fall behind in books, especially what is happening, what's leading the future of the industry. So I really thought it was great. And,
no, I agree. I totally agree with you. Yeah. And we really wanted to connect that history with the present and then arm the reader with, okay, what's next? Now I have a really good idea of what might be coming and, you know, be willing to explore it because it's, some of the things going on in the sake world are happening so quickly that it's really easy not to be unaware of what the significance of certain things, certain aspects of it are. And so we really wanted to do that in a way that it was digestible. We didn't want to create a sake textbook. We wanted to create a book that's really enjoyable. And as you said earlier, that you could have a glass of sake with and enjoy.
Right. And I really love the, you know, the visual page. I'm very visual. I really need to see in shapes and, you know, very interesting way to look at it. So I love the pages too. And I mean, throughout the book, you emphasize the importance of the differences between sake producing regions. You use the word terroir. And how important are the regions in understanding Japanese sake?
Well, for me, as I mentioned earlier, when I got into sake, sake was all from Japan. I think it's really important to get to know these regions of Japan, even if they don't have a regional style. You know, like Niigata is synonymous with Tanrei Karakuchi, and this light, dry style that has this kind of clean kirei finish, and that's cool, and it's good to know that, so that if you like dry clean sake, this might be something to look out for. But I think every region has something to offer from a cultural standpoint, from a food standpoint, that ties in with sake. And so I think it's really neat. I think you get more out of the bottle of sake that you're opening if you can look up a map, get a map of Japan and find it where that area is and what's going on there. What was the history behind the brewery? And I do think that for the guests that I've been acquainted with that have opened some sake where I explained where the sake is coming from, they absolutely love that sake. And there seemed to be more joy in their eyes and their excitement to try more sake from hearing those stories than when a bottle is brought and someone says, this bottle is a Junmai Ginjo. The rice was polished to 60%. Junmai means no added alcohol. It's just, that could be so clinical that it just takes the magic and the experiential side of what sake is all about out of the equation. So in terms of the regions, it's not important per se of, you know, necessarily indicating what you're going to find in the bottle. But I think I find sometimes we're informed about how much we're going to enjoy a bottle by what we know about it before we open it, if that makes any sense. It's like the nostalgia of it.
Yeah, so maybe I shouldn't say the regions, right? It's more like a local personalities. Like the water is different, but more importantly, people's approach to sake, the history, culture. It sounds kind of cliche, but for example, I went to Hiroshima a while ago, and one of the breweries, he said so proudly, you know, we use the well water, and you know what? This water today comes from that mountain. He was pointing the mountain, and it took 15 years to get here. I was like, and then after that, I tasted his sake. Oh, wow, that's clean minerals. And that's what you think is actual beverage, right? It's not factory made. It's actually what people make as a part of their lifestyle. And that makes sake even more special and delicious. So I think that's the whole point of you mentioned different areas where sake is from in your book.
Yeah, I 100% agree. And yeah, when a brewer points out where the water comes from, that kind of is, that's exciting, because you'll always now, when you open a bottle of sake from that producer, you're going to always visualize that mountain, and it's that helps transport you there. Another thing, speaking of mountains, is, you know, a lot of labels have symbols, these majestic symbols of mountains, maybe in the name of the sake brand that they're using, because it's located around the brewery and it's a famous mountain. And so I think sometimes there's a clue to the area that the sake is from just in the name of the sake or on the label itself. And that's really cool when you unlock those little mysteries about that sake.
Right. Okay, and to invite our listeners to maybe try to read the book, I just wanted to pick maybe one or few topics that maybe you can explain. It's one of the topics is the sake yeast, which usually people don't talk about because this can be a little too advanced, but you make it really easy to understand. So how about the trends of sake yeast? You know, it's out of simple ingredients, sake, water, rice, koji, lactic acid, and yeast. And yeast has been a hot subject for a while in the industry, right?
It has, yeah. And it's very different than wine, where in winemaking, the grapes themselves do inform a lot of the aromas that you might find on the end, you know, in the bottle. In sake making, rice isn't going to create the aromas of pineapple and lychee and, you know, white flowers and fennel. It's the yeast that really is creating those magical aromas you might find in a sake. And so, yeah, we talked to a number of producers. We visited Tokyo Nodai, which is a very important university of agriculture in Tokyo, that new generations of sake makers are attending and, you know, obtaining a bachelor's or a master's degree in, you know, microbiology, for instance, or and studying yeast, that kind of thing. And we talked to a gentleman there named Kazuoka Sensei, who's one of the leading experts on flower yeast or on hanakobo. And that was really fascinating because, again, like how I mentioned koji, I never thought of where koji came from. And surely I knew someone had to produce it, but I never thought of it because I was always too focused on how sake was made to think about that. Yeast as well. It was really fascinating to visit Kazuoka Sensei because he was basically, harvesting flowers from all over Japan. And for each flower, you could have thousands of yeasts that you culture and then have to determine whether or not they can make good sake or not. And of those, say, 1,000 yeasts, there might be 1 to 10 yeasts that are viable as a sake yeast. And then from there, you still have to, you know, do testing and all that. It's painstaking, and it was fascinating to talk. And I was like, wow, that's a lot of patience. I'd rather be on the other side of it, where some sake brewers, you know, we visited a brewery in Saya Shuzo in Akita that makes a brand called Yuki no Bosha. And Takahashi Toji, the master brewer there, he isolates yeast all the time. And basically when he's making his sake and there's a change, he's like, oh, something happened here. There's something going on here that's interesting. It's neat and I like it. And he'll culture from that tank. And so there'll be a significant population of the yeast there. It seems less of a needle in a haystack than Kazuoka Sensei's adventures in trying to find a yeast, you know, amongst thousands and thousands of different yeasts. We also visited a scientist, a brewing scientist in Kochi Prefecture, and his name is Ue Higashi-san, and he's retired now, but he's he's basically single-handedly created the yeast portfolio that you see in Kochi sake. And a lot of them are, some of these yeasts are some of the most aromatic, explosive aromatic sakes that you'd ever find. Some of them are beautifully fruity while having a very nice dry palate. And these sake yeasts have really shaped the sake persona of the sake that you would find in Kochi. And there's a lot of personality to them. They've even sent some of these yeasts to space. And now these yeasts are down, you know, several kilometers below the Pacific, where, you know, at these intense pressures are seeing how the yeast is going to change or whether or not it's going to survive. So there's a lot of really cool things that that they're doing in just Kochi alone. And so really there's this always going to be a pursuit of new yeasts that are, you know, kind of create unique aromas that, you know, that create the this new style of sake that, you know, consumers are going to really love. There's even experimentation with wine yeast and other things. So it's a really fun world to explore. And I can't imagine it's going to end anytime soon. I think that exploration is going to continue and continue on by scientists like Kazuoka Sensei.
Mm. Right. And then, well, most famously recently, the people started to use the yeast from flowers, and that kind of had more diversity in all those things. The new technology allows us to do it. So, yeah, that's exciting. And yeah, so maybe you have more time just for one more topic of one of your book items. That's I'm so glad you picked this Omi Shonin. And no other sake book captured this word, the Omi Shonin. So what is Omi Shonin and what's their role?
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, so the Omi Shonin were merchants, and they're originally based in the Omi area. Omi is an old area of part of what is present-day Shiga Prefecture. So Shiga is famous for Lake Biwa, which is the largest lake in Japan. If you're looking at a map of Japan and you don't know where Shiga is, just look for the largest lake, you know, that you see, and Shiga is right around there. And these merchants date back, you know, to the 13th century. So there's quite an extensive history. And eventually by the 15th, 17th century and later, they became very widespread through Japan. They basically peddled all kinds of goods, and some of them became sake brewers eventually. You know, they got into, you know, I'm sure selling rice and things like that as well. And it's interesting because before the book, I knew of them. You know, I encountered it when I was doing a lot of research for my sake scholar course, which is on regionality. But I was doing a lot of research on different breweries, and Omi Shonin kept coming up here and there. And, you know, I realized there's a lot of brewers that have, you know, a lineage that goes back to this famous merchant class that was all over Japan. You know, there's no shortage of breweries. One of my favorite breweries right now that I love drinking is a sake from a brewery called Hachinohe Shuzo. And they're on the northeastern side of Aomori-ken or Aomori Prefecture, in a town called Hachinohe. It's a fishing village. And they have a kind of a traditional lineup. They make Mutsu Otokoyama, and then they have a more global or modern style called Mutsu Hasen. And if you trace their history, they were established in 1740, and the first generation of the family, they're currently on the eighth generation of the family. The first generation, Komae Shozaburo, he left the Omi province and started a malted rice business. So basically he was working with Koji and things like that. And the rest is history. He started making sake, and you can see that there's a number of breweries in our book that have this ancestry with the Omi Shonin. It's interwoven into the history of their sake brewery. And I found it very fascinating to tie that in, because it's also, you also see it when you follow the ancient roads, like the Tokaido or the Nakasendo. You know, you had sake breweries that were set up along this road system that connected Kyoto and Edo. And these breweries, a lot of them were Omi Shonin. You know, it made sense. They would create their own bed and breakfast and make sake, and they were able to kind of be a one-stop shop for wary travelers coming through.
Mm, right. And then the fundamental concept, philosophy of Omi Shonin is that do the business, but you can't pursue your own interest only. And as a result, you have to benefit the societies too. So that's, you know, they say Sanpo Yoshi, that's their philosophy, three-way satisfaction. And it's timelessly relevant. So, I mean, I visit many breweries. They really have a mission to provide something valuable to the society, and that you're responsible for rice farmers. And it's not just their drinking production, I mean, beverage production. And I really thought that you've captured this word, Omi Shonin. So, yeah. And so it's just this is one example how unique your book is, because there's so many interesting angles that you included, which you don't see in other, you know, regular books. So, so what did you learn from the process of writing this amazing book?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, you know, the book was probably more than 3.5 or 4 years in the making now, since when Nancy and I started discussing the idea of it. I think one of the things is I was very fortunate to have a writing partner like Nancy. I don't think I could have written this book on my own ever. I mean, I'm a sake educator, and I love everything to do with sake, but we were able to tie in this history and culture of Japan, and which is very complex, and weave it into sake and sake making and the personalities that are in sake. And I think I was very lucky to team up with Nancy, who's a journalist and has this natural inquisitive mind for getting the facts straight on, you know, some of these really complex things, even like Omi Shonin. She would reach out to some brewers that we didn't even visit, you know, to kind of clarify things. And I think that was a really great thing. Another is not to bite off more than you can chew. It was one thing I learned, because I was undergoing the WSET diploma throughout a lot of this. I was developing and teaching my sake scholar course. I was also teaching the WSET level 3 award in sake. I was also traveling a lot, and I also have a full-time job with my duties at Key Modern Japanese and Bar. So it at some points I felt like it was just a bit too much. And I think if I did it again, I would give myself more time to enjoy more of the process of the writing of the book, where it wasn't as, you know, it was always full on, because there wasn't a lot of time to do everything. And so that's one thing I would do over again.
Mm, right. Despite the book is amazing. So yeah.
We're lucky. Nancy and I had a great agent in Max. We had an editor. Her name is Kathy Lane, who is a Tuttle editor, and Tuttle Publishing as well. We were very lucky that we had this kind of sphere of people that helped us, guided us through this process. And ultimately, I think Nancy and I did the hard work of putting this book together, but they also had a hand in helping to shape it and allowing us to create a book that we wanted and that we would be very proud of.
Mm, right. Okay, so for listeners who wants to buy the book, where it's available?
Well, it's available online through a number of online retailers. But also, if you're based in New York, Kinokuniya.
I think
I started thinking about the word, but they bought a number of books that Nancy and I signed. It's also available at Kitchen Arts and Letters in Manhattan, which is a fantastic bookstore that has a 40-year history, and their focus is food and drink. And also at Brooklyn Cura in Brooklyn, where we did a book signing. We had a sake launch party last month, and we signed a bunch of copies there. So those are three great areas to buy it. If you're on the West Coast, in San Francisco, Bo Timkins True Sake shop has it, and we're very proud that it's there. And it's also available as an online if you like e-readers as well. If you want to have a copy that is more portable, where you know, for your next trip to Japan, that's another way of going about it.
Right. Okay, great. So, we wanted to discuss your Sake Scholar course, but we ran out of time. So, your course is www.sakescholar.com, right? Then there people can find how to study, learn about sake beyond the book. So, and also, where can we find your updates online and on social media and everything else, books and all updates?
Yeah, I'm fairly active on Instagram at MTR Sake. So M as in Michael, T Tom, R Sake. And it's the same handle for Twitter as well. And also, if you're looking to take a deeper dive into sake and learn about the regions and culture and all that, the Sake Scholar course is probably something at some point you may want to look out for. So you can just look out for the website that you mentioned, sakescholar.com, and that's a great way of doing that.
Great. So, well, congratulations on all the achievements about sake, and good luck. You have a lot more work to do as a sake samurai, so good luck.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. All right. So, listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for short topics or guests, please contact us at japanese@heritageradionetwork.org or at kikotema.com. Japanese is a weekly program and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. Our engineer is Amen Spenjan, and thank you for listening. I will see you next week. Japanese is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lam, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.